This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Blue Ridge Outdoor Supplies. Scott Payne is the owner of this business. He's in Elkton, Virginia. He also has a lure line, Mountain Rebel Lures and Baits. He's got a great coyote trapping video. He's also a fur buyer in Virginia. Anything that you're looking for and your trapping needs, give Scott a call and he'll get it right out to you. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're an ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it. Fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light. Sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dig. Shotgun toter, Republican voter, Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA, cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Welcome to Trappin' Radio, everybody. We're going to have a show today that's going to be split up in a couple of different parts. Some of the things I want to talk about critical thinking when it comes to your trapping, because the trappers that are always the most resilient and the ones that seem to catch the most under any circumstances are critical thinkers. And I just want to go over a couple of quick topics on that real quick. And then I want to go into muskrat trapping. Now, that's a basic thing, and I am not by any stretch of the imagination saying that I am a master muskrat trapper, by any stretch of the imagination. But because I don't have marshes and I don't have these coastal things, you know, or the ponds with the feed beds and stuff like I see up north, I've had to learn a different system to catch muskrats. Now, to me, a good season on muskrats is about 400 or 500 muskrats. You know, that's not a normal year for me because normally I don't go after them. But I've had to learn and take different bits of information that I've compiled from several different people and a lot of experience when it comes to muskrats, that if you're not in a total marsh, and some of these I'm sure will work in a marsh, even though I've never trapped a quote marsh before like you see in South Dakota or up on the Great Lakes or anything like that. I've just never been around them. But maybe some of these things will help you, some of them won't. But first, you know, it's springtime. It's easy to kind of lose focus on what's going to be coming up in trapping season. I don't care how far away it is. It seems to be happening in about a week from now. And when you're going out and you're doing your normal things, I'm spending a lot of time out in the yard planting stuff. That's what I like doing in the spring. We're moving our shop still. And I'm amazed at how much crap a trapper collects over this many years just to move it. And it's the next yard over. I can't imagine if we were doing this across state or across country. But just to get everything set up and everything right. Now, and if you're going to order from me this week, we're shutting down the shipping part because we're trying to set all that up over there. So for this week, you can order this week online, but we're not going to be able to ship out till the 6th of May till we get everything set back up over there. So you're more than welcome to order, but just don't be in a hurry on it. It's going to take about a week, but I'm going to totally leave that up to you. Let's talk a little bit about critical thinking. And kind of what I want to talk about critical thinking is when it comes to your trapping. And you'll notice this kind of theme has been repeated over and over in some of the stuff I've been saying, but I think it's so important, whether it be when you're trapping, hunting, fishing, business, it doesn't matter what it is, you need to understand critical thinking is the reason some people always seem to stay ahead of the game, some people are kind of in the middle of the game, and some people are always struggling to get in the game. And critical thinking usually has people out front because they think about a situation, they look at everything that's going around, and they make judgment calls based off of critical thinking, not emotion, anything like that. And if you ever meet Norm, you know, and you meet me at a convention, you know, I kid around a lot and I cut up and I like playing practical jokes and stuff like that. But when it comes to business, strictly business, you can ask him, it's a totally different ball game. Because when it comes to trapping or business, I can automatically click over to critical thinking. And critical thinking does not have emotion in it. It's just facts and experience and thoughts and what ifs and stuff like that. And it's not so much cuddly and warm and fuzzy and rainbows and stuff like that. It's a lot more almost numbers based, even though we're talking about fur a lot of times. And it's hard for someone to not think that someone's being mean or something when they get in that mode. But you have to learn to be able to do that when it comes to your own trapping. And for instance, right now, from what I can tell from a lot of the fur market and talking to different buyers, the coon market's down, and it's probably going to be down next year. Well, a critical thinker goes, well, either A, I dislike trapping raccoon, and I'm going to continue to trap in raccoon, and that's what I'm going to trap, and that's fine. That's absolutely fine. Nothing wrong with that answer at all. And then you'll also have a critical thinker that's looking more for production or income base off of some of this stuff, and they go, well, I'm geared up for raccoon. I know raccoon, But if coyotes are bringing the prices that they're talking about bringing, I mean, I some of the guys that I've talked to in Ohio, they didn't take Rub Ohio coyotes to Napa, and Napa about fell out because they thought some of those were going to bring $30 and $40, $45 for rubbed coyotes. So the market changes all the time, and a trapper's got to be able to sit back, take what his wants out of it, and assess the situation. Well, if the coons are down and you're a coon trapper, if you just want to trap coons, cool. If you're trying to make income and you're a coon trapper, what do? Well, you can look at it in two ways. You got to catch so many coon that the low prices are going to be made up if you can overdo that with expenses, or you're going to have to switch gears and go into something else, which may be retooling, re-education, different things like that. And there's a lot, if you're geared up for one thing and you just totally switch over, sometimes there's a learning curve there. I don't care how much you read, I don't care how many videos you watch, I don't care how much you go out and scout, there's always a learning curve. Because let me tell you something about the internet that may hit home with you and it may not hit home with you. Everybody knows everything nowadays. Very few people can do anything nowadays. The information part is at the click of a mouse. What happens during breeding season? Well, I can Google it. How do you catch them during breeding season? Well, I can Google it. I can go to trap forums. I can ask questions, this, that, and the other. But putting boots on the ground during breeding season to catch coyotes, even though you've read it and you quote know or you know have the knowledge of it, it's greatly different than being out in the woods when you've got to do it. Like I can get online and I have no doubt I can understand how a nuclear power plant works in probably about 2 hours of studying online. That doesn't mean I'm going to be able to make nuclear power. That doesn't mean I'm going to be able to build a nuclear power plant, but I've got the quote knowledge of how it works and why it works, or like, you know, a hydro dam or anything. So I think a lot of times some people get frustrated in trapping because they have the internet knowledge or the book knowledge or the video knowledge without the experience knowledge and the bumps and bruises that comes along with that when you go out and physically have to do it. Because knowing something and be able to do something is drastically different. And I give you an example that's out of trapping that makes a lot of sense. If you get into some of the garden like I do, where you're talking permaculture and you're mixing systems of trees and herbaceous plants and annual plants and perennials and all this type of stuff, anybody in an afternoon can go and read how to do that. But you go look at people's gardens 3 months into the season and you'll see a huge difference in someone that knows how to do it and then someone that knows about how to do it. And that's completely out of trapping. We can go on and on. I know how to build a house, but if I built one, I'd be afraid to sleep in it because that's not my wheelhouse at all. But I can get the knowledge of that. So you've got to understand there's a difference between quote knowledge of how to do something and being able to do something. And I'm afraid in our culture today, everybody knows how to do stuff, but very few people can actually do stuff. So don't get caught in that trap when you're reading about how to do things, because it seems to always oversimplify and take out any of the variables that happen when you get out of a book, a video, or off a computer that happens in real life. So just thinking a little bit about that. I'm going to read a couple of quotes, and y'all know I'm such a good public reader, but I'm going to struggle through this with you because I think it's pretty interesting. Now, this is from Darwin, actually. Regardless of what you think about evolution or anything like that, keep that out of here. It's not the strongest animal that survives, nor the fastest, but it's the one most adaptable to change. And that's where I want you to think about critical thinking today. Change. Don't be afraid of it, because the next quote that I'm going to read you is a little bit longer, and it's actually talking about agriculture, but when I read it, I was like, wow. That you could easily put trap or trapping or snaring in here, and it'll apply to about everybody, including me, in one form or fashion or the other. And if you keep this next quote in line, I think it's going to be it could be one of those things. Even if you have to write this down and replay this and put it, you know, somewhere you can see it in your first shop, just so when things don't seem like they're going right, you don't get caught in this trap of knowing about something, or even if something has worked in the past. Now, I don't know who wrote this. Well, I have to take that back. I can't pronounce who wrote this. It's like James Sheed, and I'm assuming this is Indian. And the last name is Gharajaghi. I have no freaking clue, but I want to give him credit for this because it is a great quote. The most stubborn habits which resist change with the greatest tenacity are those which worked for a space of time and led to a practitioner being rewarded for those behaviors. If you suddenly tell such persons that their recipe for success is no longer viable, their personal experience belies your diagnosis. The road to convincing them is hard. It is the stuff of classic tragedy. And that's from blah, 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 blah. Starts with a G, ends with an I. I wish I knew what it was. That's not talking about trapping. It's talking about agriculture. I want to read that one more time because I want you to really think about that and how true this is even in trapping. The most stubborn habits which resist change with the greatest tenacity are those which worked well for a space of time and led to the practitioner being rewarded for those behaviors. If you suddenly tell such persons that their recipe for success is no longer viable, their personal experience belies your diagnosis. The road to convincing them is hard. It is the stuff of classic tragedy. Now, what that means, because like I said, the person that wrote this, I do not believe spoke in the English language the way that we do, or I do in the great Appalachian part of the country. We all have habits that resist change, especially when those worked for a while. And I'm, you know, just like when I talked a couple of weeks ago about coyotes that are educated. He's talking about just that way. Or you start getting flooding water, or you get a drought and you're otter trapping somewhere and the otter aren't moving. We all have these stubborn habits that we know as trappers will always work because they've worked in the past. And we know that they've worked in the past while we trapped a certain animal because we got rewarded with a catch from those animals. So we believe in this system or these habits that we put in place. Now, what gets us as trappers is if the variables change around that system or those habits. I guarantee you, if you follow most trappers that trap in dry weather, that all of a sudden get wet weather, or they're not used to frozen ground, i.e. me this year when we had 0-degree weather here. You're used to doing something that you always got rewarded for with catches, and all of a sudden it quits working. What do most trappers honestly do? And I'm not talking computer talk. I'm not talking about, you know, book knowledge on something. But if you follow someone around when their system or their habits start falling apart, they just reproduce what they've already done in the past. And they just keep going on it and going at it and going at it, even though the results get worse and worse and worse. Now, why would a rational person do that? Just like this guy's quoting, those habits has given that trapper success in the past. So to him, all you have to do is dig a dirt hole, put lure in it, and halfway bed a trap in front of it, and you catch coyotes. Or all you've got to do is dig a pocket in the bank and throw some fish in there and you catch coon. Or all you got to do is block a creek down and you catch otter. But there's a lot of variables in trapping that through critical thinking, if you understand those variables or you start looking out those variables, you'll see that a lot of the habits that worked in the past work for a very specific reason. And when they don't work now, you've got to change. Now, if a trapper asks another trapper a question and he tells him he's got to do something totally different. What this quote is saying, it's tragic, because even if someone asks somebody else that understands what's going on, because they might have been there or done that, or they've seen this before, or they're a little bit better at looking outside the box, and I'm not talking to anybody about anything specifically. I was just reading this book from Ben Falk, and this quote really, really jumped out at me about trapping. If you're always a one trick or two trick pony when it comes to your trapping, you always get variables that are going to trip you up. Just like I'm always talking about, I'm trying to find different ways, like with a portable pocket, so I can continue to trap in very wet weather in rain. But if somebody goes out in a couple of weeks early season somewhere and they can trap fox or coyotes with a dirt hole and they have success, even though the rains come, they keep trying to make that dirt hole work. If you follow what I'm trying to say here, we just have tenacity as human beings. If something worked in the past, we're reluctant to look anywhere else. And that's very detrimental to a trapper. It's very detrimental to his catch. And basically, it'll demoralize somebody over a long enough time. Because I've seen some stuff this year, like I've talked on some of the older podcasts, I've never seen before, and it, you know, and you have to struggle to figure out something to do to get that to work. And it's not always easy, and it's not always fun, and it's not always the most productive way to go that you're used to seeing in results, but there's just no way to get around that. So don't get stuck in your habits. Even if they worked in the past, always be looking at things from a critical thinking point of view, not from a habit point of view. Trappers that live off habit are always going to get pinched somewhere down the road. You know, it's part of the reason people say I come up with stuff all the time. I don't come up with stuff all the time. What I do is I observe all the time. Now I'm going to talk about 3 points of critical thinking real quick, just so you can have, because, you know, this is kind of funny. Me and my wife took this study online, and I believe in these studies online, about like I do the Tooth Fairy a lot of times. But everybody's brain seems to work very different. She took a test, and I took a test. Now, apparently, the way either people think, or they were brought up, or their chemistry, or whatever it is, one's not better than the other, because one will get you in trouble just as bad as the other will. But it's if you're right-brained or left-brained, you know, and I've heard this before. You know, artists think a certain way, and accountants think a certain way. That's kind of what I'm talking about. And you've got to be realistic to yourself. How do you think? I mean, how do you look at a problem and come up with a solution? And if you don't know how you think, you know, it's probably just because you're not being honest with yourself. You have certain people that, you know, I joke around with my wife all the time. She has no vision. You know, someone will bring something up. I'll think over it really quick. I'm already into the building phase, the execution phase, and all this in my mind in a matter of nanoseconds. I can explain it to her, but unless I can draw her a picture or show her something online or in a book or something like that, her brain just doesn't click that way. But at the same time, she's a lot more detail-orientated. She's a lot more systematic in the way that she thinks. You know, she always knows what bills need to be paid, this, that, and the other. You know, she's always looking out in the future, how are we going to make house payments, you know, during the slow time, this, that, and the other. Where my brain, just because of my personality, it's always, you know, according to this thing, it's like I live in a fantasy world. And that's probably true into a point, because I'm always thinking not just what's in front of me, but what's around me and what could be around me. Or what could happen if I did this to a trap? Or what could happen if I ran a trap line this way? Or, you know, what could? And I can, you know, almost like a fantasy, work my brain through that really quick. Well, some people have a hard time thinking that way, or thinking it's foolish that way, and it's kind of you know, there doesn't seem to be, according to Lease, what little bit of research I've done on this, there doesn't seem to be a mix. You're either one or the other. And if you are in the left brain side, where you're always, you know, it's got to be a plan, it's systematic, you follow recipes, like when she cooks, she goes by the recipes to the milligram. If I'm cooking, yeah, that looks good, let's sling it on there. That's kind of the difference there. Or, you know, we looking at business plans. Well, I can see something, think about a market, I can think about how to market it, I can think about advertising, I can think about how to upgrade the products, how to get in different markets, niche markets, yada, yada, yada. All this happens in my brain in a minute. She's got to think about each individual thing. She's got to research each individual thing. She's got to decide if she believes that or not. She's got to cross-reference it. She's got to do this. So you got two different type of brains. And if you're the systematic, almost like an accountant type person, even though you may not think of it that way, then, you know, you've got to, maybe this is what I'm doing here is going to give you a three-step plan to think more critical thinking. And with me, it's easier. And people that are like me that are easier. You know, it's just more creative. Nothing's wrong or better than the other one, but it's just different. So when you're out trapping, you're wearing different hats all the time when you're out trapping. At least to me, at least I think you should be. And when you're trapping, you got to be an observer. Now, what do I mean by that? Because I think that can be very generic, and it can be very misleading. An observer is not just someone that notices a coon trail or a coyote track or bobcat droppings. That's not an observer. An observer is somebody that is, why is this here? Where did they come from? Why did they go through here? Is it something that seems like they do this all the time? Can I use what I just learned somewhere else? Is it applicable? Or if it's not, why not? And that's what I mean by observing. Or you're using a trap and you think it could work better for this reason. Or you're having problems with a piece of equipment. What would make that better? That's what I mean by observing, not just a set, a location, a track, a dropping. That, you know, that's very basic. An observer is thinking all these things at one time, and it may be learned. I don't know. It you know, be honest, it seems like it comes pretty easy to me. So to me, I just assume that's the way everybody else thinks. And I've had to learn that that's not how everybody else thinks. So when you're going out and you're trapping or you're scouting, you know, even if you're a very systematic person, write down a bunch of questions. If you find droppings, why are they there? How did they get there? What was his travel way? Was he running the road? Was he crossing the road? Was he using deer trails, four-wheeler trails? Was he using fence lines? Was he going from A to B? Is it obvious for that reason? Do I have other places on my lines that it's very similar? Or is it different? But what can I learn from this? That's what I mean by observer. If you're having trouble with a piece of equipment, you know, like it rains, dirt holes suck. If you're using dirt and it rains, it sucks. If you're having freezing problems, not just observing that you're having freezing problems or you're having rain problems or mud problems, but go outside of that a little bit more to where you're having solutions problems. Even if you don't come up with them really quick, that's okay. But you've got to observe what's going on around you, and you got to be able to do it in a way that's helpful. And you got to be able to either write it down if you're that type person, or just have a really good memory if you're that type person. And a lot of people are somewhere in between on that because you forget things. So you got to be an observer if you're going to be a critical thinking. The next thing you got to do is you got to be an interpreter. So as a trapper, not only are you catching stuff and skinning stuff and selling stuff, you've got to be an observer and you've got to be an interpreter. So when you see something like a coon trail,
why is the Coon Trail here? Not just that there's a Coon Trail. You can stumble over a Coon Trail. That doesn't help you as a trapper any. But why is it here? Is it just for the cornfield that's over the hill? Or is it to the oak trees? Or is it to the choke cherries? Or is it to the pond? Or is it to whatever? You've got to interpret it. If you're having problems with rain and mud and freezing ground or wind or fluctuating water, whatever it is, once you observe it and you get a grasp about it, then you've got to interpret it. Now, interpreting is really hard because everybody has these quick come-to beliefs that they have in their head. There's a Coon Trail here. Well, it's woods and there's food over there. That's not interpreting. That's just giving a definition to what you observe. That's not really. You need to really get down and think about, why is this here? If you see raccoons or around here when we used to have more fox, you see them smacked on the side of the road. Why were they there? Not just fox crossed the road here, but why did they cross the road here? Because there's other places you travel along that are have the exact same formulas or reasons that the fox crossed the road here. So interpreters got to think about why. And the hardest part about this is you got to take yourself and emotions out of this. You know, you've got to be able to sit back and look at it now from a purely analytical way, where you're not taking in your past experiences, you're not taking in anything. You're looking at a piece of information and you're trying to add more information to that without corrupting that information with beliefs or myths or I just think so or my gut tells me this or whatever. You've got to be able to interpret this information. If a trap's not doing exactly what you want it to do, okay, that's the problem. You observed it. Now you're going to interpret it. Well, if I do this, what will that mean? If I do this, will the trap work? If I do this, is it going to slow it up too much? Am I going to have clay problems or mud problems or freezing problems or whatever? But you've got to be able to then interpret the problem and look at it strictly for the informational point of that. And when you do that, all of a sudden, trapping in different places and on different parts of your line becomes a whole lot easier because you're using your brain the way it's meant to be used, and that's a computer. Now, the trapper that works off of habit, like I read that quote from that, I'm assuming he's Indian, read that quote from that Indian, a lot of people work off of habit. They just repeat. They don't think. They get some success and they repeat it over and over again. But they're not observing and they're sure as crap aren't interpreting. Because if they did, very few people would be trapping the same way they did 5, 10, 15 years ago right now. Because you should be learning the whole time. Now that's going to bring us into the third phase of critical thinking when it comes to your trapping. And that is going to be an activator of some form. Now that is a word that inquires action. So when you observe something and you interpret something, then you need to do something with that information most of the time. If you see that there's a coon trail and you see a pattern in these coon trails between blocks of wood and fence rows or trees or brush or creeks or culverts or whatever it is, once you observe it and you interpret it, and then you can activate what you've learned from that somewhere else. If you figure out a better way to do a trap or a piece of equipment or a digging tool, or it doesn't matter what it is, it's pretty irrelevant, then you need to act on that, or you've just lost that observing and that interpreting that you went through. Even if, like, especially when it comes to equipment, I do this all the time, guys. There's some guys in our industry that are kind of like the E.F. Huttons when they talk about equipment. The guys that are in the know exactly who they are, and I'm not going to mention a name online because I don't want them to get hammered, because most of them are older, and they really don't want to just spend all their time on the phone asking a lot of different questions. But it could be a machine shop. It could be someone that just understands mechanically different things like that. I'm not a mechanical person by nature. I know that. So when I observe something and I interpret something and I think I've got a grasp on it, I go to find someone that understands more of how that works. Like an interesting concept I had, and I'm not the only person that comes up with these type of things, and I definitely wasn't the first one to come up with this concept, was why do we have coil springs the way that we have coil springs, and we don't have them where they look more like a valve stem spring on a car? So in other words, you could have a spring that pushes straight up on the levers of the trap. It would, leverage wise, it would be a lot better, I think, than what we're using now. And different things like that. So one of these older guys, I saw him at a convention. I was like, every time I see him, he almost grins because he knows I'm going to throw something at him. Because I've observed and interpreted something, and I'm in the mechanical realm now where you've got friction and fulcrums and leverage and all this type of stuff, and that's not really my strongest point. So I go, hey, man, what about this? And he goes, and when I asked him about those valve springs, he said, we worked on that about 12 years ago for about 2 years. The issue with them is because the leverage is so good holding the jaws shut and getting them out of the ground, it's really hard to set by hand. So we made setters. We built this. And then to turn loose something that you don't want, you've got to use setters, and it was just such a pain to use that it didn't work right. And he was telling me these stories they went through. Well, even though I observed something and I interpreted it, it didn't really help me out at the end, but it could have. And that's the point. If the action is out of your realm, find somebody that knows that realm a little bit and kind of bounce it around with them. But be careful when you're talking about equipment, especially if you're thinking about selling it, who you tell it to. I'm warning you on that, bluntly. Trappers, just by nature, for whatever reason, a lot of them, if they come across an idea and they're starving for money, they'll run with it and forget they ever talked to you. So you've got to be very careful about who you build relationships with. And you need to keep that in mind when you're building these relationships. Is this somebody that I would want staying at my house? Is this somebody that I would trust with this information? If I wouldn't trust him with my bank account number, I'm not going to trust him with an idea that really may work. That's the reason when I get a lot of people that want to talk to me about trapping stuff and when it comes to equipment, I try to get out of that situation as fast as possible. Because it's their idea. I don't want that in my head. I don't want to forget about it and think it's mine 5 years from now. I don't want them to think that I told somebody else. If it's not mine, I just want away from it. So when people try to send me these, stuff all the time, I'm pretty squirrely about wanting to hear what it is or seeing pictures of it or different things like that. If you open source it, like on a forum or something like that, you've lost it. And that may be fine because a lot of guys just are looking for something to make themselves better, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if you open source it or you tell it to the wrong person, there's a good chance you're going to lose that. So you've got to be an observer. You've got to interpret the information that you have, and then you've got to be able to activate on that. And activation can be something as simple as if you see a coon on the side of the road, you interpret why he's there, and then you can actively go find that specific location over and over and over and over again. Now see, you're gaining ground. But if you just see three coon on one spot on the side of the road and you jump over and you put out some DPs and you catch a couple of coon, what have you really gained? A couple of coon, that's it. You haven't really got the critical thinking of trapping part where if everybody's trapping the creeks, because that's what I learned from Red. When I took coon instruction from Red O'Hearn, he had locations that it took me a while to figure out why they were working. And the most amazing thing is, with all the coon trappers in Iowa, he had all of these locations to himself for the most part, except for the standard creek or the standard culvert, stuff like that. Everybody else was mostly, it seemed like, trapping out of habit. See a creek, see a culvert, you see this, you jump out, you put in some 220s, or at that time, footholds, dog proofs weren't really that viable yet. And they were trapping off habit. But Red is a critical thinker. And Red was putting this information together, and after he observed it, and then he went out and he actively sought this out. So he had action involved with the mental part of the game. And that's why most of his trap sets are with no competition. And most people there wouldn't believe that unless they went with him on his line. So it's just something. But critical thinking, guys, when it comes, if you want to be, if you ever want to get to where you're making good money trapping or professional trapping or an ADC trapper, I think it's a little easier with ADCs because they ADC guys that deal in urban settings, because they're in different situations all the time. You have to be a critical thinker, you're going to be out of business. But when it comes to fur trapping, I think it's easy to get in a rut. I think it's easy to trap off a habit. And I think it's easy just to get in zombie mode and over and over and over and over again, and you try to caveman yourself through there. And I've done it. I've got the caveman trapping t-shirt. I've done some very inefficient things, and I beat on it so hard that it seemed to work out. But that doesn't mean nowadays, especially when I'm getting older, fatter, and slower, that I want to be a little bit smarter about it. And if I can go run 50 miles of traps instead of 100 miles of traps and catch the same amount of animals, I'm way better off. And the critical thinking part of this, not that I'm a super critical thinker, but it allows me, and I do keep these things in my mind. When I see something, well, what can I gain from this right now? And what can I gain from this in the future? And then I try to go out and actively use this information. And what it does is it changes the way that I trap all the time. When I started running trail cams and the night vision equipment, it changed the way I was trapping. You know, the portable pockets now, it's really changed the way that I'm doing a lot of stuff. Flat sets changed the way that I was doing dirt holes. The mafia sets over the snares. Instead of using so many body grip traps on otter, I'm using way more footholds now. And my catch goes up from doing that. All that came from critically thinking about what was going on in my world at the time and how I could actively use that to be a better trapper. So that's just, you know, kind of the Dr. Philosopher Clint section of the week, because when I saw the quote, it just really struck a chord with me. Because I do see a lot of guys that get caught up in a panic in the middle of trapping season because they've trapped out of habit for so long, and all of a sudden the variables change and they just start scrambling for anything they can get their hands on to try to fix this problem really quick. And I bet you if they would have been a critical thinking trapper from years ago, when they see something different, they can go into a different mode, figure it out really quick, because critical thinking is a skill. You know, most guys think they do four things really well. All guys think they can shoot, all guys think they can drive, all guys think they know how to start fire, and all guys think they're good in the sack. Most guys suck at pretty much all of those in reality if you put them to the test. But in their mind, they're superheroes in every one of those aspects. And critical thinking is the same way. No one says, well, I just don't think, I just run out of habit. No one puts it that way. No one goes out and goes, you know, I really don't know what the heck I'm doing, but I know if I do this enough, I catch something. No one thinks about it that way. No one's going to put themselves in that situation, you know, especially publicly. But a critical thinker is someone that just critical thinks. they work through problems. They see them, they work through them, you know, they interpret it, and they go activate on it. And it seems like, from a public perspective, that they're always ahead of the game. And if you want to be that guy that's ahead of the game, then work on your critical thinking skills. I'm sure there's books on it. I don't know. Never looked up critical thinking, but there probably is. But it's just a mindset of how you look at your trapping or anything else for that matter and how to go about it. Well, let's talk a little bit about muskrats in the last part of the show. Like I said, where I'm at, guys, we do not have feed beds. We do not have marshes per se. We got beaver swamps, which is totally different, especially here. You know, when I've been up on the Great Lakes and I see these almost like land masses that's got water in them, and you've got all these feed beds, and I've trapped in Grand Rapids, Michigan before, and all the ponds had these feed beds, and everybody kind of trapped those things the same way, which, to be honest, did not make a lot of sense to me. I give y'all kudos for just knowing where to put a trap and y'all catch something. Because the critical thinking part of me, I wanted to know why, where, how, everything about it. And it was just, you just put a platform, put a trap here. It made no sense to me whatsoever. But luckily for me, I don't have to deal with that down here, because I probably pulled what little bit of hair I have out left trying to do that, because I want to know why. That critical part of me, I want to know why. I'm like a little kid all the time asking questions. So I've never had to deal with that on a big scale over long term. I've never had to learn it. What we have, and a lot of guys have around the country, are creeks or brooks or streams, whatever you want to call them. We have rivers and we have ponds. We have beaver swamps. That's pretty much how our world is when it comes to our water. Some of these have more muskrats than others. Some of them have muskrats some years, and some years they don't. We don't have a large concentration of muskrats pretty much anywhere, because we don't have a food source like you get in these sloughs, in these marshes. I mean, part of the reason there's so many rats there is the food they're living in, their food source. But you get on the Tennessee River, or the Hatchie Bottoms out in West Tennessee, or something like that, you don't have cattails and arrowroot and all this stuff growing all over the place where they just constantly can feed and breed. They got to work for a living here a lot more. They're a lot more exposed. They have to deal a lot more with the birds of prey and the mink and the coyotes and the fox and everything like that. So they react a little bit different here. In most places that I've trapped, you know, when you find muskrats and you see sign, they're not really that hard to catch. The problem is, like, you're on the Tennessee River here, you know, people talk about seeing muskrat sign. Well, obviously they're not dealing with 6-foot waves coming off barge after barge after barge going down the river, because it blows everything off, you know, as far as sign goes. Seeing a track, that's funny, because it's like being on a beach. I mean, the waves are just beating it to death. And then we have water levels that drop up and down all the time. So you go to a log and you'll see droppings at water level, and you'll see droppings 8 foot up where the water's been up. So it gets kind of complicated. One of the first ways, and I recommend everybody read this book, and I don't have it in front of me, so I'm probably going to screw up the title, so don't send me hate mail. Bill Nelson had a book, and I think it was called just Water Trapping. Very precise and to the point. It's not a very big book. It's like they were all written back in the you know, the 60s and 70s, where they're almost like an overgrown pamphlet. But there's quite a bit of stuff in there. And the way that I started trapping muskrats when I came back from Alaska was very simple. I would see any sign of a muskrat, or what I thought was a muskrat, and I would take a lure on a stick, and I would impale that in some form of vertical structure, and I would put a trap in front of it. You know, Bill Nelson went as far, and I've done it, where you take a fork and you scrape all the ground around it where it looks like a muskrat digging. Not so sure how important that was, but it gave me confidence, because I had confidence in Bill Nelson. And when I found muskrats, I could catch muskrats pretty easily doing that. And I still use that system today. I mean, think about how easy that is. If you're wanting to catch muskrats and you're on a creek or you're on a river and you're not getting washed out by boats and barges and different things like that, or your water level's not dropping out too bad, you take a good muskrat lure and you put it on the end of a stick. The stick's on a 45-degree angle. You put that out towards the water, and then underneath the water, you've got a trap. You cannot get any simpler than that right there. If you're doing lured sets and you take it beyond that point, and there's not a reason for that, a lot of times you're overcomplicating something. Any type of complicated system always has chinks in the armor for the simple reason it's complicated. So, I mean, that was the basis of how I started trapping muskrats. The next thing that I did is I started trapping on the river. Muskrats, believe it or not, if you're new to trapping, muskrats used to be about $1.50 down here in the South for years. Every now and then, they would hit two. Well, all of a sudden, one year, they hit about, we thought we was going to get about $4 a piece. I took a canoe down on the Tennessee River, and before I finished this line, I was in a boat. I was using footholds, colony traps, 110s, 160s, and 220s, and I lived on that river for about a month. And I caught, it was just shy of, I believe, 600 muskrats during that time. Expenses were not that bad because I can be at the river in 30 minutes. You know, the way I was pretty much doing most of the river, because the way our banks are, because it's a man-made lake, I pulled the boat that was tied off to me around my waist most of the day. So I walked the muskrat line in the water because it was simpler. Then when we got too deep, I would use the trolling motor to get across it. So I'm searching the bank. And I'm going to be honest with everybody out there, I am not a muskrat master by any stretch of the imagination. I've been around some, and they could see stuff that I couldn't see. But I kind of did it just off of trying to use critical thinking. When I saw a sign, how am I going to catch this little thing? You have to hunt them down here. I mean, really go out and hunt muskrats down here to catch them. And most people in the country, it's the same way. And I know it's frustrating when you watch a video with somebody out in South Dakota and they're just throwing floats in every ditch and pond and hole with water in it and they're catching two muskrats. That ain't the case here. So I would get out and I'd pull this boat. On the river, the clay is so hard that to push a stake in the ground a lot of times was way too much energy for a muskrat set. I mean, I'm out there with a sledgehammer trying to beat it in the clay bank because the waves have packed that clay so hard, it's like asphalt. And they've packed the bank so hard, they're like asphalt. So just sticking a stick in the side of the bank, especially on the lakeside, I mean, it was a nightmare. I was having to use metal poles to stabilize, 3/64ths, that's not right, it's bigger than 1/16th. 3/32nd metal poles to be able to stabilize a 110 in the bottom, because that's the only thing I could physically get in the bottom without having to use a hammer all the time. Sticks would just break. That was not going to happen. So it made the way that I started muskrat trapping really, really hard. You know, because I was using the drowning system. I watched one of Charlie Dobbin's water videos. I think he's got creeks, ponds, and rivers, or creek streams, and something like that, which is still on the market. Great video, by the way. And he was using a slider. I was using a slider, but I was using more of the system the way that Bill Nelson showed, and it was just a pain in the butt because it didn't fit my area. So I started using 110s, and what I was finding is because the boat traffic was so bad on the Tennessee River that a muskrat hole looks fresh if it hadn't had a muskrat in a decade, apparently. And the banks are full of holes. So I'm putting conibears, and I'm having to fight so hard with the clay to get the conibears in there that I couldn't get out a ton of them in a day. I mean, you know, you couldn't get 100 out in a day. There was just no way, because you had to physically use a critical thinking just to get the things to stand up. So that didn't work very well. And if I set up 50 holes in a day, only two of them are active. But you can't tell, because when you see the videos and the books, you know, they got the silty bottom and they got the smoke coming out of them, and you know, it's hard and everything else is soft and you got stuff floating. That don't happen on the river. So me not knowing exactly what I was doing, I just started putting 110s in front of our 220s, depending on the hole, in every one of them things, trying to get as many footholds as I could. Then I started setting up the logs that were floating in the river. And the way I was doing that was pretty simple, because there's always blow down trees and stuff from our flooding. And I would put lure up on the log. I would hopefully try to find droppings or see where something's been crawling up and down. And I would just use two nails, and I would put that trap right below level. And amazingly enough, that was outproducing me setting the den holes, because the den holes were so unreliable because they all look fresh. I mean, they look fresh year-round here. And that was picking up. So I'm starting to pick some of these things up. And what really broke ground on me on catching the muskrats were two things on our systems down here. One, I started looking at using body grip traps almost like a bottom edge set, even though the trap sometimes wasn't underneath the water the way the bottom edge set is. So I'm looking at these banks, and I'm looking at, because, you know, I'm standing in them, so they're pretty shallow, and a lot of them where you had most muskrat sign, or old holes anyway, were straight up and down, and some of them had undercut banks. Some of them had, it would just go straight up from the water pretty much, where the water's eroded it off. Sometimes there'd be cover and sometimes they wouldn't. Well, I'm observing these muskrats in the evening and in the mornings. And I watched several of them that they would hug the bank as they swam. So a lot of them are just out in the water swimming around like they're high on marijuana or something. Some of them, or most of them, would seem like they would go really, really close to that bank. So what I started doing, almost like a bottom edge set, is I take those 220s and I would set those where they're perpendicular to the bank. So if I had a flat bank, even if there was no groove or even if there was no overhang and the trap could be, you know, a couple inches out of the water, or even if it wasn't, I would put a dive pole over it just like I did a beaver. And then my muskrat catch really started to jump up. Now, everything I've read is you find holes and you fill the holes up. Well, that didn't work that well. Well, then I started using the logs, and that started getting my numbers up. Then I started using this perpendicular setting of a body grip trap against any structure that's straight up and down where I see any type of muskrat sign. And those outproduced anything else that I was using. I mean, this is all simple stuff. But I had to go hunt these little boogers down for any of this to work. I just couldn't go out and set them anywhere. I had to go hunt them. Out of a canoe, I may go 3 or 4 miles in a canoe beaver trapping before I come across anything that looked like muskrats. And then I would get out and I would do this same procedure and I'd catch those muskrats. Well, then I started getting into the colony traps. Let me tell you guys, if it's legal for you to use colony traps, that is what you need to start gearing up. You can buy good ones and you can build good ones. It's totally up to you. Norm builds some great traps. There's a lot of other people that build great traps. But the colony traps are something, if you really start forcing yourself to use them, you'll be amazed at what you catch in these things. So I started replacing the 110s with the colony traps in the holes. Why? Because I didn't have to stabilize them the same way to hold the trap up. So I'm walking in the boat, and anybody that's seen the year-long Blitzkrieg video, it looks like I'm going out on a shrimping or a lobster expedition when I'd go out muskrat trapping. I could walk in front of the boat, I'd see a hole. If it was a hole, I shoved a colony trap in there. It took me a second and a half. I'd come to another hole, I would shove that in there. If I saw one of these perpendicular banks, I'd grab a 220 and I would shove it on that perpendicular bank. If the trap was underwater, I'd put a dive pole on it, just like I would for beaver. If I saw a log that was somewhere around the bank and somewhere around the vicinity of where I'm seeing these muskrats, I would take a foothold trap and I would put it on the log with the nails where they would get on the log to get up there, take a dump. And those only really work, guys, around here in January and February, the tail end of our season. I could do that in December all day long and hardly ever catch anything. So, I mean, you got to observe these things for them to really work. Floats on our river, I've tried every float known to man. I've built, had built, bought. I've done everything I could. Floats to me in my areas that I've trapped have been such a letdown and such a space hog in the boat or canoe. I just don't really see what it is. But I tell you what, every year I'm trying a different way to do it. You know, I'm determined there's got to be a way to get our muskrats to get on a float, to go through a trap, over a trap, down a hole, something with some type of floating thing, because I could put out a bunch of them from a boat and cover a big area, but I ain't found it yet. So I'm using these colony traps. And, you know, when I first started, they were standard sizes, 5 and 6 inches, probably 2 foot long, something like that. And then I would find a hole that I'd catch a muskrat. And if I caught a muskrat, I would take that trap, set it back in the boat. I would take bigger traps that I had that were three-doored. And what I mean by three-doored, some of these things were 3 foot long, 6 or 7 inches square. And you had the doors on the end, just like a standard colony trap. And then in the middle, it would have a third door. So you'd have to look at it, and what you were doing is, if there was actually muskrats in these holes, because I didn't have a lot of them, the muskrat would come through that first door, it could go through the second door, but then it's trapped in the back, kind of like a standard colony trap, and it would allow me to catch more of them. So when I started that system of it, now I'm rocking and rolling. And that's how in Tennessee that I caught that many muskrats. And that number of muskrats really is unheard of. Even at that time, the buyers can believe that I didn't bought the muskrats and I caught the muskrats, because most people just don't do that. It took me a month of critical thinking to figure out how to do that here, because the information that I was seeing, or the way that I used to with my habits, trap them when I'm on smaller creeks and I just see where there's some muskrats using a trap and lure, the way Bill Nelson talked about it, did not work on the river. Now, since that time, I've got to where I'm using the colony traps more and more. If I can find a pond or a creek with a pond or a river or whatever, and there's a culvert, and I can dig it out or whatever to put a colony trap in there, or two or four or six, I don't care what it is, I'm putting them in there. I will know in 48 hours if I've got muskrats in that area by doing that. I think I've got some video of me doing this that I'll have uploaded later in the summer. It's a very simple thing. You notice I keep stuff as simple as I can. I do not try to complicate it. Another thing with these colony traps I've realized is, if I'm in a beaver flow, trapping beaver or otter, and you got old dams, the places that you would normally set your body grips for your beaver and otter, if it's got several of these old dams, a lot of times muskrats will go through a 330. So I may set up the beginning and the end with a 330, and if there's a couple of dams in between, and that run is, you know, if it's kind of washed out, you may have two or three across there where the water's flowing. I'll try to shove in as many colony traps as it needs to fill those runs up. And most time it's two or three. And I'll know really quick if I've got muskrats in the area. Because if the muskrats are going up or down that creek, they're not going to get out and crawl over the wood of the dam. They're going to float most time downstream with that current. And they'll go in that colony trap, and I'll know really quick if I need to start spending more time there. After two or three days and I don't have a muskrat in any of those, pretty much I'll pull those out so I don't have to carry everything out on the last day, and I'll use those traps somewhere else. I'm getting into more and more of the bigger colony style traps. What I mean by big is wide. Now, certain states, I know y'all have got regulations on this where they got to be a certain size and a certain length. You need to check your laws before you do anything I tell you to do, especially if you're in a northern state, because your rules seem to be getting tighter and tighter. I'm using them now that are 2 foot wide, and they're kind of funneled at the front. Norm, I get them from Norm. Norm Blackwell builds them for me. I'm going to be taking these things out a little bit wider this year. I'm going to also going to have them where figure out a quick hinge system where I can put out almost wing walls on these things that I can take this trap now to 4 feet or 5 feet really quickly and not have to carry a bunch of stuff in there with me. What I'm finding out is if there's a flow of water, I can drop the trap in there. Right now, sometimes I'm having to use two of them or three of them. I can drop the trap into the water where it's convenient, and I can see really quick if there's muskrats. Because if there's not any muskrats there, I don't need to be spending times down there digging a pocket or putting lure out or trying to find holes or anything like that. I'm kind of testing all this water out. And I may hit 8 or 9 creeks where I'm at, and there's not a muskrat been there for years. Then all of a sudden I may hit a creek, and I can catch 8 or 10 or 12 of them. But I'm using these bigger colony traps almost as test vehicles. You know, if it's big water and I can put them down on the bottom edge, they work just like a body grip trap. I have yet to catch a mink in one. I know people have. I have yet to catch a mink in one. But I'm not really setting them for mink either. But I'm using these colony traps now to test them out. Now, if the water is absolutely where I just can't figure out how to use a colony trap, then I will get down and I will start hunting, and then I'll go revert back to Bill Nelson's system of lure on a stick with a trap in front of it. What I did last year, which worked out very well because it's such a self-contained system, is I was just using a portable pocket. I could have a 3 or 4 foot of chain on a small trap. I could use the portable pocket as a stake. I'd put my lure inside of the portable pocket. I would smear the rim of it with Unfair Advantage because muskrats really seem to like stuff that glows at night. And then I could just shove it anywhere that was convenient for me that was close to that sign, set the trap in front of it, and catch muskrats. You can't get any simpler than that. But that's how my evolution of muskrat trapping has got to the point where it is now. But it's always super simple. And it is always trying to find ways to make it faster without complicating it. Because I see some stuff people do that's insane. You know, one of the things that I'm regulated to do on some of our bigger creeks around here is setting floating logs. And I've tried it because the water goes up and down so much, lure on a stick does not work. Colony traps, if you got the right situation, will work sometimes. But, I mean, you're talking not that many places. You hardly can find holes because one day the water's 8 foot above where you set the thing and you can't even find the trap again. So what I've learned to do with floating logs, and I learned this from somebody down here that I don't know who he is, and if you're listening to this, thanks a lot, because this was ingenious of way he was doing this. He apparently would go out ahead of season, which I've done this since then, and he would pull logs that were floating in the water to where he wanted them in bins, where you had deeper water, where you had a better chance of muskrats being. And he would take trapping wire and he would wire that off to the trees going out into the water. So this thing could move up or down 10 feet. It could move left and right 10 feet. Unless you got a big flood that something grabbed that your floating log with a wire on it, it would break it. But it was always working. And then he would chop out and put his trap where it would naturally go down in the water the way it naturally floated. And he was staying in business all the time. And so now that's kind of the way that I'm doing. That's the closest way I've ever found floats to work. But there again, that's only now in January and February. it's not something that works early season, because I've tried to force that to happen and it doesn't work. All these things with muskrats, it's pretty much boils down to you got to find muskrats. And a lot of people think that they don't have muskrats because they try to do something they seen somebody else do somewhere else and it doesn't work for them. If you're going to try to catch muskrats, if the muskrat market holds up and you want to go out and you want to learn how to catch these things, you've got to go out and you've got to figure out what works in your area. And I can't tell you that. I can't tell you why another system doesn't work. You're going to have to work all that out through critical thinking. Nobody else can do that except you in your area. You're going to have to figure out what bodies of water hold them. What are they eating? Believe it or not, on the Tennessee River, they eat mussels. They're meat eaters. That's why they're big. They're protein eaters. Then they eat what vegetation they can get, because we don't have very many cattails or anything like that besides just grass and roots that grows on the bank. But it's up to you to use critical thinking to go out and figure out how to catch those things. They're not difficult. A lot of times, you just got to figure out your system to match your area and stuff starts clicking a little bit. But the biggest thing that most of us have to deal with are muskrats in the eastern part of the country where we don't have these great big marshes or pothole systems is we got to go out and hunt them down. And unfortunately, most trappers either don't have the dedication or the time to go out and actually hunt down enough muskrat locations to do them any good. So they throw their hands up and go, we don't have any muskrats. Well, at $14 a piece, if I can catch a muskrat for $14 or a coon for $14, I'd much rather catch a muskrat. Because I've got less time and less energy in putting that animal up, and it costs the same. Pretty much to catch. So to me, it's a winner when I do find them. I'm planning on doing a whole lot more muskrat trapping this coming up year. One, because I just want to. It's enjoyable. It's one of those things that I always learn when it goes out. When I go out and trap for them, it's like I'm always learning something, and it's just one of those really cool things. Well, I'm going to go ahead and close on that. If you want to know how I trap muskrats, there you go. Super simple stuff. If you're wanting to know how other people do it, you're going to have to ask them. But the biggest thing is that critical thinking, guys. You're going to have to learn to do it, and you're going to have to learn to do it quickly. And you're going to have to, more than learn how to do it, you're going to have to learn how to be an activator when it comes to what you've learned. And I don't care what walk, crawls, or flies. With critical thinking, you can catch it. 2 foot, 4 foot, no foot, I don't give a crap. If you think about it and use critical thinking, if you need to catch it, you can put steel or a snare or a body grip trap on that thing somehow or another. Well, hope y'all are enjoying the spring. Hopefully it's warming up for everybody out there. It's pretty nice down here anyway. Go out and have some fun this summer. Go fishing, go scouting, go figure out where you're going to go next year, and just have fun being out in nature.